This episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 10th of December 2013 on Monocle 24. Section D is brought to you in association with Lexus. Hello and welcome to Section D, Monocle 24's show dedicated to the world of design. Coming up today, we keep our eyes peeled, under hangover-friendly sunglasses of course, for new finds at Design Week in Miami.
The Design Miami is unique in the sense that it's the only fair entirely dedicated to collectible design and really covering the entire spectrum of the 20th and the 21st century.
We question the enduring legacy and increasing popularity of probably the world's most misunderstood building material, concrete.
First up, concrete has its place, so below ground, for substructure, and also for exceptional one-off buildings and things that no other material could do. Concrete is fantastic.
And then Monocle's art team join me in the studio to unpick the design of the upcoming issue of our annual seasonal broadsheet, Monocle Alpino.
It's a mixture of sort of art and geography. It's just charming, and it's a kind of really, you'd never read this story anywhere else but here. It's a really sort of undiscovered thing.
That's all here on Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. With annual editions in Basel and Miami Beach, Design Miami has carved out its place as the world's leading forum for exhibiting collectible design from the 20th and 21st centuries. And whereas fairs like Salone del Mobile in Milan are all about taking the pulse of the world's leading manufacturers, Design Miami has its sights set firmly on highlighting individual designers, both the historical and the emerging. We sent Monocle's Barrett Austin for a visit to this year's fair, and he came back with this.
Ever since launching in 2005, Design Miami has earned a place among the world's most important forums for design culture and commerce. Now in its ninth year, the fair has grown larger than ever before. This year, the first week of December saw 37 hand-picked exhibitors and more than 30,000 attendees descend on Miami for the week-long event. As a partner fair occurring alongside Art Basel, there's a clear synergy between Design Miami and all the satellite art world events, though it's unique in its focus on the functional object. Marianne Goebel has been the fair's director since 2011. Under her watch, Design Miami has expanded its range of programming and firmed up its spot as one of the world's top forums for exhibiting, collecting, and discussing 20th and 21st century design. As we sat under an outdoor pavilion designed by Brooklyn-based Formless Finder, I ask Goebel how the fair differentiates itself from other global design forums.
The Design Miami is unique in the sense that it's the only fair entirely dedicated to collectible design and really covering the entire spectrum of the 20th and the 21st century. Milan, the Salone Satellite in April, is the meeting point for the design industry, where you can discover all the new work coming out in serial production. I would say it's the meeting point for the entire industry, while Design Miami is taking place in a different context.
The different context, Goebel points out, has everything to do with the atmosphere surrounding Art Basel and the nearly two dozen satellite events that occur alongside it. In the same way the art fairs surrounding Basel allow galleries to focus on work from single artists, a similar approach allows dealers and curators to highlight the work of individual designers, those both living and dead, and expertly curated solo shows. I asked Goebel if the increasingly common format of exhibitors focusing on a single designer perhaps offered a deeper experience for visitors.
No, absolutely. I'm personally a big fan of solo shows because it really allows you to explore in depth the body of work of a particular designer. One example this year is the outdoor furniture by Walter Lamb. It's outdoor furniture designed in the 1950s, and the first pieces were actually put together of tubes that were recuperated in Pearl Harbor from the sunken ships, and that then turned into a serial production of extremely elegant outdoor furniture, which I had never heard about being European. Maybe it's more well known in the US. And we've opened three hours ago, but I've heard really enthusiastic reactions from people all over the world who, like me, had never heard of him before.
Mark McDonald is a gallerist from Hudson, New York, specializing in mid-century American and European design. It was his gallery that brought the work of Walter Lamb to this year's fair. Exhibitors like McDonald have the rare opportunity to educate thousands of visitors on the work of a designer they might never have otherwise heard of. And while some might consider this a commercial risk, McDonald's opening day sales tally did not seem to disappoint.
We've sold three big groups of people to three different clients, and we only have about three pieces left of the pieces that we brought down here. So now we're trying to take names and hopefully be able to satisfy people's want for this. We have a couple people here in Miami who have bought things and they want to have a lot more.
Well, this year's fair was also replete with exhibitors showcasing more familiar names. Much of the work shown stretched the possibility of what one might expect to find inside a contemporary exhibition hall. One such example was Jean Prouvé's 1944 Maison de Montable, a prefabricated structure designed to solve France's housing woes amid the destruction of World War II. Installed piece by piece, the structure was sent from France inside museum crates and exhibited by noted Paris gallerist Patrick Séguin, in a way that made it seem that most anyone could assemble one of Prouvé's rare prefab homes with a basic guidebook. Séguin gave me a tour while explaining the internal workings of the 64 square meter home.
Here, we're facing this compass, which is structural. It looks like a solid piece, but actually it's hollow. So every piece can be removed by hand by one person. This is how it is. Fix the compass on the floor. That big monster crossbeam goes on the floor. By the fact you unbolt this upper bolt, then here you bolt what we call the pignon, and then you lift by hand and it seals the structure. It's fantastic. If we look at this sentence here, which we print on the wall, the house of my dream is made in a factory. So at the time after the war in France, I don't know in America, but in France was a lot of resistance against industry. Prouvé was industrial, and this is an example how beautiful it is, how emotional it is. I mean, that's my perfect perception now in this house, how beautiful it is, and it's industrial.
At a price tag of $2.5 million, Prouvé's Maison de Montable may not have been the fair's most affordable structure, but it was certainly the most imposing, and unsurprisingly, also one of the most popular. And while the historic 20th century designers helped the fair draw deep-pocketed collectors, the works of contemporary designers like Brazilian architect Guilherme Torres are just as significant. Torres was selected by Swarovski to create a site-specific installation inside the convention center. With a fairly open-ended criteria for his installation, Torres chose to explore the concept of the mangrove, the naturally occurring coastal habitat common in his native Brazil, to design Miami's goal of offering itself up as a laboratory for contemporary designers. Torres was able to depart from the functional requirements of architecture to the purely conceptual. Inside the mangrove, with clouds digitally superimposed on the walls and trees made of crystal glowing overhead, Torres explained the value in his experimentation.
To me, it was my best experience until now. Okay, because I could think outside the box, okay? And it was a gift when you could have this kind of experience. I started this project 3 months ago, and I must tell you that something's happened to me, okay? Now I start to feel more freedom.
While the week of Design Miami has sometimes been overshadowed by the reach of Art Basel, there's a clear impression that the fair remains a mainstay in design circles. And the range of programming and exhibitions offered throughout the week have ensured Design Miami stays relevant. I spoke with the fair's co-founder for his impressions 9 years on.
I'm Craig Robbins, CEO of DACRA and chairman of Design Miami. I'm blown away. It's our best show ever. It's nice to be part of something that is growing, becoming more mature, and also becoming more deep.
Robbins is one of the city's top developers and the man behind the city's rapidly developing design district. And he's quick to point out how fairs like this have helped alter the perceptions of a city like Miami.
Miami has transformed from being a fun in the sun kind of a city to being a global city of cultural substance. And of course, as someone who lives here and believes in the city, it's especially inspiring to me to be part of something that's meaningful.
Back outside, at the entrance to the pavilion, Marianne Goebel describes all the planning that goes into making this week become a reality. While the commercial goals of Design Miami are certainly ever-present. It seems there's more to the fair than transactions alone.
Well, we are a platform with many different players and ingredients, and ultimately we will be happy if our exhibitors are happy. I personally am happy when I have the feeling that we have a lot of visitors who are having a good time and who are obviously either finding pleasure in pieces that they know about, that, you know, the specialists that they're looking for something they know about, or design virgins who come in for the first time and discover this world and find out that actually functional objects are much more than just what they see and that they can learn and experience them.
For Monocle in Miami, I'm Barrett Austin.
Thanks, Barrett. You're with Section D. After the break, we'll be getting the latest design stories from across the Atlantic with New York design journalist Dan Rubenstein.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Welcome back. Up next, we talk concrete, but first, we're staying stateside for our weekly regional focus. Following on from last week's jaunt in Miami, New York design journalist Dan Rubenstein chatted me through some of the big design stories that are taking hold across the Atlantic.
I did a whirlwind tour of Design Miami this year, and it was great. The mood was really high, and multiple people kept telling me the same thing, that everyone seemed to be in a great mood with lots of great energy. The sales were very strong, surrounded by the usual orgy of marketing events, promotional power, celebrity spotting, and lots of Prosecco.
Miami is known for that, isn't it? It's known as being sort of the party capital on the design calendar. Do you feel it sort of kind of changing? Is it getting a bit more, you know, critically acceptable there for the design industry?
Yes, to me, there were two bits of Design Miami and Art Basel Miami Beach this year that seem to be bringing things up to a new level. One is the opening of the Perez Art Museum.
Exactly.
In Miami by Herzog and de Meuron. That seemed to be putting Miami on the map, you know, from an architectural perspective, as they really needed the new space. There are many new museums that are going to be built in its immediate vicinity. In the design district, Sue Fujimoto is also building a new structure there for the design district. So it seems to be that it's being taken more seriously on the design calendar. And also, just anecdotally, the design commission for the entrance pavilion at Design Miami this year was by Formless Finder, which is a very young firm from New York. They're very conceptually rooted. And the piece is quite, you know, a little controversial in the way that it was put together, but it was very interesting.
Was that a pile of sand?
Yes, a tent pile. Some people didn't know what to make of it, but the guys that behind it, they were a runner-up for the Young Architects Program a few years ago and were a fan favorite to win, which of course they did not. But the level of work seems to be getting higher and higher in terms of the commissions and the installations, the people who are building things permanently there. And I think this all somewhat started a few years ago, at least to a new level, with another Herzog project, 1111, the parking garage. Mm. So I think that kind of really, you know, put things on a whole different new level. And of course, you can't go to Miami without, you know, noticing the massive amounts of cranes that have yet again sprung up all across the horizon. Mm. They went away for a little while and now they're all back. And there's constantly new developments. They're not running out of space, let's just put it that way.
Yeah, boom town indeed. And yes. In terms of what kind of was on display there, did you see any trends?
Yeah, there were a lot of trends this year at Design Miami. There was a lot of jewelry by designers and also jewelry by artists, a lot of jewelry galleries showing there for the first time. There were also the famed gallerist and shop owner from Milan, Rosanna Orlandi, also showed for the first time, mm-hmm. which was a very welcome thing for the design community. And as well, there seemed to be this strange dichotomy between, on the one hand, very conservative, a lot of French design, conservative from a modern sense, of course, like Charlotte Perriand and Jean Prouvé, and the very much alive Maria Perge. Fendi did a collaboration with her. And that's on one side. And then on the other side, you had a lot of digitally informed art, like Martin Boss, Human Since 1982. The Human Since 1982, they're a Swedish collective, much like the collective Random International. Mm-hmm. And the Human Since 1982 sold a piece in the first hour of the VIP preview, which is even before the press preview, for 33,000 euro. So, you know, not bad for an emerging Swedish collective you know, that makes things like clocks and LED light boxes.
Looking forward to New York and kind of what's happening there over the course of next year. It's kind of a couple of key events, particularly in the museum industry there, that sort of one to watch, isn't there?
Yes. The museum scene in New York has been evolving much like a lot of major projects in architecture have over the past decade. A lot of museums set forth during the last boom a lot of ambitious projects to expand, to move to a new home. Mm-hmm. The Whitney Museum moving down to the High Line in Lower Manhattan in Chelsea in the Meatpacking District is, of course, a huge example of that. But there's a lot of change in the air. The Cooper Hewitt National Design Museum, which is a Smithsonian institution, their director, Bill Moggridge, tragically passed away in 2012. This past summer, they have a new director, Caroline Bauman, who's who had been working there for many years, and she was promoted, and they have a huge renovation of the Carnegie Mansion where the Cooper Hewitt is based, and that will be opening in October.
And that's been quite a massive thing, hasn't it?
Yes, quite massive. There's a lot of money required because not only does it need to become a more curator-friendly and visitor-friendly space with bigger exhibition halls and bigger and better everything, but it also has to reconcile the fact that it is a national landmark space. Mm. So one of the main criticisms by the design community in the past is that it's very difficult to put on a really robust contemporary show in a space where, you know, you can't put nails in the wall and so on, because it is an incredibly beautiful space. So this renovation will be huge, and I think people will be really seeing how it all turns out. There's a lot of landscape work being done as well, which of course is always, every square inch is prized in New York City. On top of it all, the Carnegie Mansion will also be LEED certified, so that's actually kind of exciting.
Fantastic, yeah.
And then on the other hand, the Museum of Arts and Design has a new director who came over from the V&A, and he was just installed in October. Mm-hmm. And so this year will be his sort of, you know, we'll start to see his imprint on the museum as a whole. And there will also be a new chief curator eventually, as their head curator is retiring at the end of the year.
And then, of course, later this year in May, we've got Design Week. Some sort of changes there, isn't there? I mean, it's been a sort of troubled couple of years.
New York Design Week has always been controversial and has always been frowned upon by some people in the industry as being too close to Milan Design Week. Mm-hmm. It comes, you know, just 1 month after. And a lot of the European brands, especially in the crisis, have struggled to find their place in how much they should be investing in the United States, especially when it comes to marketing and events like New York Design Week in May. What's changing here is last year was the first NYC by Design, which was the city-sanctioned official celebration of design that ran from Frieze New York all the way through to the International Contemporary Furniture Fair. Of course, that was the brainchild of Christine Quinn, who is the city council speaker. She ran for the mayoralship. She did not win. Mm-hmm. So people are wondering how much political will there will be moving forward in the future with our new mayor, Bill de Blasio, who's incoming. And we're going to see, you know, where NYC by Design goes from there. I'm quite curious. I'm quite positive. I think there's always great energy in New York for design, and it seems to just keep growing and growing. One thing that I'm curious about is that the French design show Maison et Objet is moving to the United States for the first time in May, competing with the whole hubbub of NYC by Design, but in 2015. So I think New York in 2014 in May is going to be a big year to prove, you know, that New York is still the design capital and not Miami, which is where Maison et Objet is moving to.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? So the sort of geography has been re-leveled in the last couple of years.
Exactly. And you can't help but notice that brands are more than willing to roll out the red carpet for Design Miami and for Art Basel with installations and things in stores and things like that. But they are a little bit more reticent to do so in New York in May. And some people blame the sort of the trade nature of ICFF in May. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people just, you know, have said to me, if you really want to communicate design to an American audience, you should treat it as art. And so by putting Design Miami next to Art Basel Miami Beach, it makes it much more palatable for an American audience. And that's why Miami and Art Basel Week is such a strong pull for all things design and architecture.
Well, I just kind of want to talk a little bit sort of bigger picture. I mean, what is the what's the sector like for a young designer in the States now? I mean, it's, you know, it's one of the sort of the greatest design sort of nations of all time in a way. What's its sort of reputation like on the international playing field, do you think? Is it still the buzz there? Is it still a real... I mean, obviously, there are great American players in the scene.
I think people keep rediscovering American design, and it keeps shifting. When you talk about things like New York Design Week and ICFF, immediately people will compare it to the Salone in Milan, or they'll compare it to the London Design Festival. America simply doesn't have the manufacturing base in things like furniture to justify a really strong local design atelier culture. But people forget that a lot of young designers coming up, you know, they have to worry about things like health insurance and rent. And they can't afford to design for a furniture company in, say, Italy and somehow make a living. A lot of designers here, like abroad, are moving to doing work for interiors. A lot of them get gobbled up by major architecture firms. You know, New York is still a capital of architecture, just like London. Mm-hmm. And so if you're a young designer and you show a few great pieces, and let's say the Rockwell Group comes calling and they want you to design custom work for their, for them full time, you know, what are you going to say? I mean, that's a huge opportunity to do really great work. And it's one of the reasons why atelier culture is very difficult to get off the ground here in the States. And at the end of the day, designers need to have some sort of access to manufacturing. And at the same time, a lot of our biggest brands in design are not necessarily located in New York. Brands like Emeco, brands like Bernhardt, Herman Miller, and so on. So not to be so close to them is always a challenge. It's not like France that, you know, has their capital is also their major metropolis. So for us, you know, we have that issue of being separated by large amounts of land between us.
That was Dan Rubenstein there with our regional focus on the USA. This is Section D with me, Tom Morris. What do the Pantheon in Rome, London's Trellick Tower, and the Three Gorges Dam in China have in common? They're all made from concrete. The mixture of water, cement and aggregates became the pioneering material that allowed architects to forge large-scale urban projects and residential dwellings to their liking, due to the sturdy and malleable nature of the substance. Today, however, there are many who are beginning to argue that concrete has had its day and that its use should be relegated to the sidelines in favour of other, more sustainable materials such as timber. And then there are others who say it's never been so popular. Monocle's Alexa Firminich paid a visit to the old vinyl factories in Hayes, Middlesex, to attend debates celebrating and critiquing the use of concrete.
Let's start with the show of hands first before I say anything. Who agrees with the...
Architecture journalist Clara Dowdy chairs the discussion and begins by asking the audience for a show of hands for and against concrete. The reaction by the 20 or so students, designers and journalists sitting around in the room is surprising. Not one person raises their hands in support of the motion that concrete's days are over. First up on the floor was Piers Taylor, founder of Invisible Studio, an architecture practice that attempts to create unusual and intelligent buildings. I caught up with Piers in the old vinyl cafe before the debate to ask him about the viability of concrete in today's world.
Well, what's interesting is that there's a lot of misunderstanding around concrete, and fundamentally, the assumption is that concrete is all bad, but actually, concrete is a very useful material. It actually is quite a low-impact material. It's quite a low-energy material. And the problem is just the sheer volume of concrete that's used. So it's the most widely used material anywhere in the world, concrete. And, you know, because of its abundance, that's the issue. And globally, carbon emissions from concrete are something like 8% of all carbon emissions are from concrete. So the issue is the sheer amount of it and the lazy use of it. So what I mean by that is that, first up, concrete has its place. So below ground, for, you know, substructure, and also for exceptional one-off buildings and things that no other material could do, concrete is fantastic for. The issue is that there's so many uses of concrete that could be done differently. So, for example, Field and Clegg Bradley, who are architects, they demonstrated that 21 years of operational carbon could be saved just by changing a roof structure from concrete to timber. 21 years just for the roof structure. And it made no difference to the performance of the building. Yet engineers just specify it. And the other issue is that it's impossible to be exact about concrete specifications. So basically, it is an inexact science. Engineers over-specify because you can't be specific about concrete performance.
Next up, in defense of concrete, was Paul Monaghan of AHMM Architects.
That's a very honest approach to how the materiality and specifically the structure can be crafted to make architectures legible and plastic. We were very lucky, really, about 12 years ago to work on the Barbican Art Centre for about 12 years, actually. It's taken a long time for us to fiddle with it. We still haven't got it right because everyone gets lost still. But really, that is, you know, one of the greatest celebrations of concrete anywhere in the world, I think. And on the whole, I mean, it's a remarkable achievement for that small firm at the time, where almost it has a level of detail that you'd find in a back extension everywhere in that building, that there is ingenuity everywhere. I love its versatility. You know, it can be a floor, it can be a wall, it can be a ceiling, it can be structure, it can be a bridge. Not anything else can be. They'll probably try and tell you Tim McCann, but it isn't. It can't. It can't quite to the same level.
The advocates of concrete make the point that its sheer versatility and ability to be transformed into innovative and beautiful forms is simply unparalleled by other materials that exist today. It's not just the stuff of high-rises and highway bridges. In the right hands, many colourful, creative and delicate buildings have been fashioned from concrete. However, as Andrew Woe of Woe Thistleton Architects argues, there is a massive environmental cost linked to the use of concrete that cannot be ignored.
Concrete, in my view, is the material of the 20th century and not the material of the 21st century. The amount of carbon dioxide emissions caused by the production of concrete really means that this material shouldn't be used anymore. We need to be looking at alternatives to concrete, primarily through timber, through using engineered timbers. We have built a 9-story building, we've got a 10-story building on site, all made completely from timber. So I think, you know, it'll take us time to work out how to replace concrete in some situations, but I think for the main part, it's time to really, to park concrete, to put it to bed, to consign it to the last century and move on.
Back in the debate room, I spoke with William Hall, the former design director at Phaidon Press, who recently published a book celebrating concrete.
Well, I think concrete still has a reasonably negative perception in the public eye. People, when they think of concrete buildings, think of kind of rain-stained social housing that's dilapidated and badly maintained. And my aim with concrete was really to try and reposition people's perception of concrete, because it is the preeminent building material of our age and of the last century. And most of the most architecturally interesting and pivotal buildings of the last 20th century are of concrete. So if you think of Le Corbusier, or you think of Louis Kahn, or Frank Lloyd Wright, they all built substantially in concrete, and it became a massively influential material.
And what would you say to people who say that concrete is cold, it's inhuman, it doesn't mix into the environment?
I used to live in Waterloo, and I used to cycle to work in Clerkenwell. So I crossed over the bridge twice a day, and I went past the National Theatre, which is one of those buildings that's been open to that accusation of being sort of cold and inhumane. And the thing that I noticed doing that was how mutable the building was, how much it changed in different lighting conditions and different weather conditions. And it became apparent to me that concrete was a really humane material and a very expressive material, much more expressive than a glass building or even a brick or stone building. Also, very often the sort of history of the material, if you think of the National Theatre in particular, it has this in-situ concrete which has the echo, as it were, of the timber boards that were used in the formwork which we used to construct it. So I think it's not cold or expressionless at all. It's a really characterful material.
What's one of your favourite buildings that best exemplifies why you think concrete is such a great material to work with?
I would say the Bangladesh Assembly Building by Louis Kahn. It's a vast building, very stately and calm and solid, quite unlike anything else really. It's fortress-like, but it has these ribbons of white marble that run laterally up the building to give it some scale. But it was built in Bangladesh, which was the poorest country in the world, and I think it is a real... it took 23 years to build. It was built entirely by hand. So bamboo scaffolding, no cranes, no machines to mix the concrete. It was all done by hand. And I think it's an extraordinary achievement and an indication of the grandeur and the simplicity that concrete can offer.
When I ask William how he feels about the other participants' arguments against concrete, he says there's simply no comparison.
I feel sorry for my fellow speakers because I don't think that they have a great argument. Concrete is absolutely pervasive. There are 7.5 billion cubic meters of concrete used every year. That's one cubic meter for every person on Earth. It's ubiquitous, and one of its strengths is that it's globally available. And it's all very well for us in the developed world to say, oh, well, we should be using sustainable woods, but if we were to ban concrete tomorrow, the people that would suffer the most are those in developing countries. And I think it's easy to forget that when we concentrate on the sort of the glamorous kind of side of the avant-garde architecture, which is one of the subjects that we're probably going to spend more time on today. But concrete is ubiquitous and essential, and there isn't a replacement for it at the moment.
The show of hands at the end of the debate was striking. Suddenly, from a starting vote of zero, around half of the room's hands were raised in the air against concrete. This is an important and timely debate. We're witnessing concrete's resurgence due to major technical advances. But today's conversation definitely also illustrates that the age-old material might not be the building block of the future. For Monocle, I'm Alexa Firmenich.
You're listening to Section D here on Monocle 24. Later this week, the special Monocle broadsheet Alpino will make its annual outing to the slopes across North America and Europe. It's the fourth edition of the newspaper, and this issue features everything from Switzerland's bunkers, a report on the tiny country of Liechtenstein, and in the design section, an illustrated guide to traditional mountain gear. Monocle's creative director Rich Spencer Powell and photo director Poppy Shibamoto donned their down jackets and joined me in the studio after we went to press to chat over Monocle Alpino.
There's one story I'd like to pick up on mainly, which is this is a real charming story, and I think it's a real surprise to us in the office because we weren't quite sure it would work out. And with Alpino, it's this bigger trim size, so the pictures have to work. You know, it's always a little bit of a mystery, and it's about the culture of ski maps, and it's a lovely story about the guy that actually hand paints these ski maps with all the routes on, and it's a mixture of sort of art and geography, but it's just charming, and it's a kind of really, you'd never read this story anywhere else but here. It's a really sort of undiscovered thing, but it's a good one.
Yeah. What about you, Poppy? I know it's always a bit of a challenge with Alpino, shooting it before any snow has fallen across the Alps.
And then everyone asks for, like, Poppy, get the snow. I can't make
it. We had a little bit. But what are some of your favourite?
I think the company ski town in your design section.
Me too.
It looks so nice. It looks like these are all like little village of like, oh, it's the coffee cups and everything. Mm. Everything.
Which for the viewer listening, it's a story on a company, Alpine Town, that was built in the 1950s by one of Italy's biggest energy firms, which is now sort of slightly derelict, but this kind of really beautiful little kind of famous five-ish sort of little village in the hills.
I found it difficult to pronounce. What is the village called?
Porca di Cadore. Go on, have a go.
Porca di Cadore.
Almost.
It sounds like you just swore in Turkish or something.
But it's so cute. It sounds just like how it's named.
And what else we've got? There's quite a lot of illustration in Alpino, as usual, a lot of these kind of single pages.
Yeah, there's some good stories actually that are illustrated. The opener, we've opted away from doing a map, which we traditionally do, and we've done a ski scene by our Korean illustrator Tommy and it's lovely. It's really dense and packed. The back page is our kind of one of our longest collaborators, Satoshi, has illustrated 10 Alpine myths, and it's just hilarious.
Yeah.
Again, very, very charming. And then there's another nice story and culture about the business of Ski TV, and it's another Canadian duo, Studio TP, and they've done a really nice alpine scene, skiers coming down the hill, all the gates, the TV, and the like winner's circle at the end thing. It's lovely, really good, nice punchy colours, and Alpino's sheet-fed job's a bit technical, but it means it prints very brightly, so the illustrations will really kind of stand out.
Yeah. What's it like kind of designing something like these newspapers, which is a slightly different paper stock, obviously a very different size? How kind of out of the box is it for you compared to the normal magazine?
It's a little bit out of the box. I mean, it's obviously it's the same principles. It shouldn't be too worrying for our design team, but you can't print it out full scale. And, you know, I think as a rule for designers, you have to kind of cut and paste things together. So normally we just print them out at 80, sort of 85%. It makes it harder to read, actually. It's quite hard for the proofreaders and the editors because everything comes a little bit small. And it's bizarre how just a 15% decrease in size when you're kind of proofing and working can be quite tiring. I've spoken to Andrew. He says it makes his eyes ache more at the end of an Alpino day than a normal Monocle day. And it's surprising when the chromelins then come in, and even though it's just 15% bigger, it's like, oh, wow, now it all looks really good. And so it's just, you just have to believe in what you're doing kind of thing. It's a bit like shooting on film and looking at a Polaroid and knowing that actually when I get that back in film, it's not going to look out of focus and the colours are going to be grubby like that. It will be crisp. And it's the same thing here. It's just, you just have to have a little leap of faith.
Yeah.
But it's good. We enjoy it. It's a nice change.
But Poppy, there must be a challenge for you because when you get these sort of pictures and the big pictures in Alpino.
Yeah, usually that again is okay for me. I have a big screen, so just always dreams of running pictures big, so this is my time. Only thing I have to be careful is sort of paper slightly tinted, so when we have a snow colour of pure white to print, like if there's other things around it, that makes it contrasty, so that white really feels white. So that's sometimes I will just be careful about. But yeah, running pictures big is a good thing.
That was Monocle's Rich Spencer-Powell and Poppy Shibamoto. After the break, we talk ad hoc architecture.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24. When was the last time you shoved a candle in a bottle for a dinner party, used a stack of books to prop up your bed, or added one thing to another to make something new entirely? Years-old pragmatism, you might argue, but also the central idea of an architecture and design movement from the 1970s, coined ad hocism by architectural theorist Charles Jenks. Jenks and another architect, Nathan Silver, said about writing ad hocism, the case for improvisation, a manifesto of a book championing the reshaping of design theory. The book has been reissued with new extracts from the authors. Co-author Nathan Silver popped by Midori House for a chat with our producer Aled John. He told Aled why he and Charles Jenks came back to review this pioneering work.
Charles Jenks and I met in about 1968, and he was then getting a doctorate at the University of London. I was teaching at Cambridge in architect. We were both architects. And we discovered that we were interested in the same sort of things. And that was, we were interested in making things out of other things, in turning something which was an object that had previously been made and improving it by adding parts on. And Charles came up with a name for it, which was called ad hocism. And that's now gone into the language, actually, because nowadays the Oxford English Dictionary defines ad hocism as the policy of improvisation. And I was then writing for the New Statesman, and I wrote a piece about Charles and ad hocism, and it got a very big response. And I said to him, you ought to write a book about this. And he said, why don't we write a book together? So that's what we did. And he had the funny idea that we should write it separately. I should write half of it, he should write half of it, which is what we did. And it was published by Doubleday in 72. And it then subsequently went out of print, and it became, I'm sorry to use this terrible phrase, sort of a cult book. A lot of people started, you know.
If you don't say so yourself.
Well, a lot of people got in touch with me and wanted to know whether I still had a copy, or it became very hard to find and expensive. And then many years later, the V&A bought a chair that I designed, which was called the ad hoc chair, and they put it on show. And then the V&A curator said, gee, it's a pity this book is not still in print. And I said, well, maybe you have any suggestion about that. So MIT Press have now reissued it. They were the ones who decided this was a groovy idea.
So it's been reissued. Have you added anything to it? Has anything changed since 1972?
Yeah, we've expanded it and updated it. Charles wrote a new intro, and I wrote a new afterword, and their color section. So the core of the book is the original 1972 book, but there's a section with color pictures at the beginning and another section with color pictures at the end. And we make our observations about how ad hocism has been transformed in the four decades since we first wrote about it, and it has been.
So let's get on to how it has been. Ad hocism is an idea that you use existing systems and then add on things to them.
Yeah, and in the beginning, we identified a lot of notable ad hocist historical buildings, like, for example, the whole idea of revivalism in architecture, which started in the Renaissance, when the Renaissance started taking classical buildings of antiquity and bringing it up to date. That was, in a sense, an ad hocist idea. And so it goes back to the 15th century when Alberti was doing this. There's a wonderful ruin in Arizona in the Canyon de Shelly, which is a building that's built way up in a rockscape. And that was built out of the very stone of the cliffs, where they took the pieces and they domesticated nature for the first time. I mean, that was, in a sense, ad hocism. And more recently, I mean, there was stuff like Charles Eames's house in Los Angeles, where he used some existing structure to do that. And this was 1949. Saint Pompidou in Paris, where they take a sort of framework and then put in a lot of individual parts which can be replaced and are being replaced continually. And the idea is that the superstructure always remains, but the individual parts keep changing. Those are ad hocist buildings.
Looking to the contemporary then, the book spans across not just buildings, but also cultural institutions, the arts, the media. Mm. Your section of the book in particular focuses on the arts, the city, the consumer marketplace. Can you give me some clear examples of how the kind of ad hocist mentality or idea has been used in, say, the consumer marketplace or the arts or the city?
Well, the great example, I think, is Jane Jacobs in 1961, I think it was, when she came out with a book which was an attack on conventional town planning, where she said that the idea of the city is completely wrong if they think that you should just demolish a whole part of it and build a whole part of it new. And she believed in small streets, many different ages of buildings together, a lot of people on the streets, a lot of eyeballs on the streets for safety and for conviviality. I mean, she was a great ad hocist. The idea of buying things in catalogs, going back 40 years, the Whole Earth catalog and stuff like that, and then that fed into the internet and the way that internet buying is now possible, so that everyone has accessible, you know, the products of practically the whole world online and able to be within reach in a very short time. These are essentially ad hocist ideas.
How important a break from the conventional narrative was this idea of ad hocism? Because you describe it, and when you break the word down into its composite parts, it's something which anyone who has been forced to, you know, shove a candle into a bottle or whatever it is, be practical and pragmatic, and they need to work with the elements they have.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, the word means, ad hoc means for this. It means for this purpose. And the idea of volition and readily available, that's at the root of it. But it's also possible to take that idea, which is essentially a pragmatic one, and use it expressively in an artistic way or in a socially dynamic way. For example, the idea of flash mobs, where you get a lot of people to come together and sing a song in a square, as they do. I mean, a flash mob is not really improvised, but it's made to look as if it is improvised. And the enjoyment that people get out of it is to realize, yeah, it was all cooked up for this purpose, but they made it look like it was just natural. And that's a very interesting aesthetic thrill, I think.
That is a distinction that Charles Jenks makes in his foreword, that not only should it add to existing systems, one of the key ideas of ad hocism is that in terms of the aesthetic, it should be complex and striking.
Yeah.
So I wonder if there's a jarring perhaps between what some people might term good design or well thought out design and an ad hocist approach to design.
Yeah, well, certainly 40 years ago when we were starting to get buildings like the Centre Pompidou, I mean, that was a tremendous affront. When the building was going up in Paris, and this was just a year or two after we wrote our book, and those guys hadn't read our book, but a lot of their assistants had. I mean, the people of Paris were absolutely horrified by what they were saying. And it was only when the building was complete and people started voting with their feet that it became a tremendous success. And everyone realized, you know, what a wonderful building it is. So it is a jar. I'm trying to think of another good example like that. There were some buildings built. James Stirling did something. There's a gallery in Stuttgart called the Neue Staatsgalerie, which is very complex, full of parts that come from different kinds of buildings. And he puts it all together in a kind of, you might say eclectic, except eclectic is not really the right word. It's different. It's things that are sort of ripped out of one context and shoved into another. Eclecticism was another phenomenon where they try to make everything work smoothly. And the fact that it came from different places, you know, was sort of smoothed over and you forgot about that. Ad hocism generally takes a much more
practical approach.
Well, practical, sometimes jarring, sometimes specific, surprising, wakes you up to something like that. And I'm not saying that ad hoc design is the only way to go. I mean, there are a lot of wonderful architects who do the opposite of ad hocism, who I think are terrific too. But ad hocism has a particular flavor and reality that I just love.
Is there a snobbishness from the design camp, the good design, the kind of aesthetic design camp, versus the ad hocism, or the other way around? Is there a snobbishness from the ad hocism camp?
I don't see that, because every well-equipped designer or architect has used ad hocism sometime or other. For example, Frank Gehry is not really an ad hocist architect, but there are certain buildings. There was a house he did for himself in the 60s where he used chain link fences and he used all kinds of materials and ingredients which were way out. He doesn't do that stuff anymore. Now he does very complex, purpose-made designs. And like that, I mean, I'm trying to think of, in Barcelona, Gaudí's Parc Güell is full of fragments of pottery and so on that he stuck together. Now, Gaudí didn't always do stuff like that, but he did a lot of it. So there's certain of his works that are very ad hocist. So I don't think there's real snobism or stuff like that. I mean, I haven't heard any of it anyway.
A key idea for me here is the difficulty perhaps of rolling out an ad hocist approach to design in, say, urban planning. Do you see that there's a challenge for ad hocist architects or architects who are inspired by that kind of mode of thinking to put their work to place in say, London or New York?
Well, I sure do. Well, certainly in London, I mean, after World War II, you know, when the results of the Blitz and where there are bomb holes in all kinds of places, there was a ready-made ad hoc, you know, opportunity, which London took on very, very well. And that was exactly what Jane Jacobs would have said was the right approach. And what was going on in the 1950s in places like New York, for example, was the opposite of that. Places, the outlying parts of New York, like Queens, where whole sections were just laid waste and comprehensive urban developments were done without any richness or any amenities at all.
Yeah, the contrast between the approach to sort of city cleanups, as you may see in New York or London, Giuliani's approach in New York in the 90s to clean the facades of the buildings rather than bulldoze them down.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think ad hocism is unstoppable. I mean, we didn't discover it. You know, it's age old. We called attention to it, but nobody needs any prompting from us in order to do it. To appreciate it, perhaps they do. I mean, that's what I hope we're helping people to appreciate it better and to understand that used to be a dirty word. People say, oh, no, he's just had an ad hoc approach to this. It's completely wrong. You know, there's no principle. Well, ad hocism is a principle, actually. I mean, it's the oldest principle there is. And the development of a lot of inventions, for example, the bicycle, which we go into, you see as the bicycle develops, you get part added to part and improvement added to improvement, and it gradually evolves into, you know, something like a modern bike, and it's still evolving. This is the way scientific progress, or technological progress happens. This is the way style and art changes. It's so deep in our culture in every way that, you know, calling attention to certain aspects of it in design is easy stuff.
Nathan Silver, architect and co-author of Ad Hocism, talking to Alad John. And that brings us to the end of this week's Section D. Today's show was produced by Aled John and edited by Holly Fisher. You can contact the producer Aled at awj@monocle.com if you have any comments, queries or requests. I'm Tom Morris. I'm playing you out today in honour of last week's fair in Florida. Here's Dear Miami by Rasheen Murphy. Thank you very much for listening. Bye-bye.